If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, so welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. We're very pleased to have Dr. Jeffrey Lee here with us, who is the chair of the Department of Surgical Oncology at UT MD Anderson Cancer Center in Texas. Sir, welcome to BTK.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So could you give our listeners a little bit of background about where you grew up, where you're from, and where you trained, and how it came to the point where you're the chair down there in Houston?
Sure. So I grew up mostly in New Jersey. I was an undergrad at Dartmouth in New Hampshire. I spent 11 years at Stanford as a medical student and surgical resident. Also did a research fellowship in cancer immunology when I was there. And then I was lucky enough to get a spot in the clinical fellowship in surgical oncology at MD Anderson and came down to do a two-year fellowship in 1991 and in 1993. Charlie Balch, Dr. Balch and Rafe Pollack, who was transitioning to chair at that time, invited me to join the faculty. It's been a fantastic place to be ever since. I've been there now for 25 years. About 5 years ago, I was asked to take over as chair of the Department of Surgical Oncology. Rafe was retiring from his position as chair and was really fortunate to be able to do that. So surgical oncology at MD Anderson would be considered general surgery at any other institution. At the time included breast surgery. They're now a separate department. Orthopedics, now a separate department, as well as all aspects of GI surgical oncology, liver, pancreas, colorectal, and peritoneal surface malignancies, also melanoma, sarcoma, and endocrine, as well as pediatrics are part of surgery.
Well, thank you for that introduction. And this is Vance Thon, who is a graduate of the MD Anderson program. And Dr. Lee, you certainly are a master of many disciplines within the field of surgical oncology. But one of the things that we'd like to talk about right now is one of your research efforts in melanoma. Do you care to explain or expand a little bit about your research efforts?
Sure. I've been involved, Vance, as you know, interested in the immune response to melanoma for a long, long time, and that over the past couple of decades has transitioned to include not just immune response but also inflammatory response to melanoma and other cancers, as well as melanoma genetics. So about 8 years ago, I partnered with Chris Amos, a molecular epidemiologist, to begin to look at the very large number of of specimens, blood specimens, particularly that we had collected from thousands of melanoma patients over a couple of decades that I'd been on faculty. And we first did a very large melanoma genetic study, looked at inherited genetics of melanoma, identified some novel genes that predispose patients to developing melanoma, including some immune function genes. And then what we'd always wanted to do was to begin to look at the host factors that help to determine whether or not a patient who develops melanoma will go on to be cured of the disease after surgery or might develop recurrence and more serious melanoma. So we began to look at markers of tumor thickness and also other circulating protein markers of immune response and inflammation. And we've been very focused on lately on inflammatory markers, because we think, based on some of our early work, that these are very powerful predictors of who will go on to develop recurrence of a melanoma and have more serious melanoma. And we also think these are really areas where, now that we have effective targeted and immune therapies for patients with melanoma, we think anti-inflammatory treatments will be the next vanguard of important treatment. So we've been looking at, in particular, CRP and vitamin D, C-reactive protein, a generalized marker of inflammation, important in the outcome of patients who have cardiovascular disease at risk for heart attacks and strokes, but also cancer, we think, and vitamin D. Low vitamin D levels are very common in melanoma patients, kind of surprisingly, as well as in the general population. And if you have either a high CRP or a low vitamin D, some of our large recent studies suggest that you're more likely to have your melanoma come back, respond poorly to treatment, and even die of melanoma. So we think these are two areas where reducing CRP or raising vitamin D might be really important therapies for patients, including patients who seem to be cured after relatively straightforward surgery but are at risk, as we know, in a somewhat unpredictable way, based on things like stage of disease, in an unpredictable way to having their melanomas come back.
So the vitamin D correlation seems very contradictory. We live in a region of the country where we don't get a lot of sun, so vitamin D has been linked to adverse outcomes with breast cancer.
Correct.
When dealing with research specifically relating to what we think is a sun exposure, how did you come to discover that correlation?
Yeah, we weren't the first to describe low vitamin D levels in a subgroup of patients with melanoma, but we were the first to look at coordinated evaluation of vitamin D and CRP, and also we were the first to show that melanoma-related death, not just overall deaths, were higher in the patients with low vitamin D levels. We don't know yet why so many melanoma patients have low vitamin D levels. It does not appear, based on some of the work that we did, that melanoma patients are avoiding sun exposure so much after they get diagnosed with melanoma. They're not. It's not necessarily that they are, being more cautious, and therefore their vitamin D levels fall for that reason. We found that the vitamin D levels actually were surprisingly stable, whether they were obtained shortly after a patient was diagnosed or several years after that. We don't think it's that these patients are avoiding sun exposure so much. You know, sun exposure is important in controlling vitamin D levels, but it's not the only thing. Vitamin D is an acute phase reactant. That means that in an inflammatory response, either acute or chronic, vitamin D is actually used up and levels fall. So it's possible that the low vitamin D levels are not directly related to sun exposure so much, although there is a little bit of correlation there, but rather there are other mechanisms that are important, including chronic inflammation. That may mean that we have to give very large doses of vitamin D. We just don't know yet, in order to get the levels up in patients with either serious melanoma or maybe other cancers like breast cancer, as you mentioned.
So looking forward 5 years, 10 years, there were talks about moonshot and curing melanoma among the many malignancies. What do you foresee as your research driving in terms of clinical applicability and our ultimate hope and hope for a cure for melanoma?
Sure. This is a tremendously exciting time to be involved in taking care of melanoma patients and participating in research for patients with melanoma. We've had over the past 5 to 8 years a series of really major advances, as you all know, in the care of melanoma patients, starting with targeted therapies, BRAF and MEK inhibitors alone and then in combination, and then checkpoint inhibitors against CTLA-4 and PD-1 or PD-L1. And these treatments are dramatically effective in a subset of patients with serious melanoma. There are more and more responses to treatments that look like cures. And so that really has changed, has changed the battlefield for us, I think, in important ways. And we really are looking forward to curing more and more patients, even with very serious melanoma. We're operating on more patients with advanced melanoma, including stage 4 disease, especially after they have what are often partial responses to these targeted therapies and immunotherapies. So it's tremendous to be able to offer helpful treatments, and in some cases we think curative treatments, to more patients with melanoma. I do think that the research that we're doing in chronic inflammation in particular is going to open up a new front, beyond chemotherapy, radiation therapy, immunotherapy, and targeted therapies. I think treating chronic inflammation is going to be an important part of how we manage patients with melanoma and other cancers, certainly within 10 years. And that means medications, that means measurements to determine whether chronic inflammation is an important mechanism in an individual patient, helping or permitting their cancers to be more aggressive. And in that subset of patients, especially medications, agents, vitamins, to abrogate or interrupt the inflammatory response, maybe diet and lifestyle changes as well. I don't necessarily think that treatment to interfere with inflammation will be a cure in and of itself, but I think it will help to cure more patients and even prevent melanomas in high-risk individuals. I think these mechanisms are probably important in colon cancer, breast cancer, and many common cancers as well.
Well, Dr. Lee, we do appreciate the time taking us to go through that melanoma research. It definitely offers a lot of insight into, a very difficult disease to treat. But I think we're going to move on to our dissection of the day. And with you, Dr. Lee, I think we're going to discuss adrenal incidentalomas. And I know by the time the patient gets to you, they've had most of the workup done. But for the students, residents, and staff that listen to this podcast, it'd be great to go through what workup you expect to be done before they even get to you, and how do you guide your treatment for there. So maybe we start with what type of workup do you have these patients do before they come see you?
Sure. So, an adrenal incidentaloma implies that the imaging study that identified the adrenal tumor was done for another reason, not directly related to the adrenal tumor itself. The identification of the adrenal nodule or tumor, therefore, was a surprise. And we're therefore starting with the assumption that the patient doesn't have any obvious signs or symptoms related to that adrenal tumor. It's absolutely true that sometimes we find that the patient does, in fact, have often subtle signs or symptoms that that are reflective of a hormonally active tumor, for example. But the phrase incidentaloma implies that the imaging study was not done because one suspected an adrenal tumor. So if we're starting from that assumption, then we would first start with a physical exam and a history, just like we would with any patient. We would look for evidence of on history, evidence of hormonally active tumor, things like high blood pressure, things like a history of hirsutism or extra body hair, things like weight gain. On physical exam, we would look obviously for evidence of Cushing syndrome, of excess cortisol production. But then if the patient is referred to us, we would review the laboratory data that had been obtained already, and we would look for evidence of a hormonally active tumor. And if there was missing laboratory data, we would want to fill that in. What we look for in particular is on the routine blood work, first of all, we would look for any evidence of anemia that could suggest that the patient has an underlying malignancy or even a primary adrenal cancer. Uncommon, but for example, if a patient had a significant anemia, we would be concerned that they might have an underlying cancer, for example, a colon cancer with metastasis. If the patient had abnormalities in their biochemical evaluation, for example, a low potassium, this would immediately alert us to the possibility of an aldosteronoma, particularly if the patient was also hypertensive. So we would always want a patient to have a blood count and electrolytes, renal function tests to help us interpret the rest of the evaluation. Those are really the essential basic the essential basic blood work. Beyond that, we would look for a series of specific hormone tests. And, you know, to some extent, as the referring doctor, you're going to be filling in examination tests that have already been done. But in particular, we would look for a morning cortisol level, an ACTH level, a renin, an angiotensin, ideally an aldosterone, although you could argue if the patient's not hypertensive and their potassium's normal, it's not necessary. We like a DHEAS. And then if those tests have been done, we would also prefer, even if the ACTH and cortisol are normal, that the patient have an overnight low-dose dexamethasone suppression test that is a 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test, a milligram of dexamethasone late at night, and a morning cortisol level. Those are the two essential tests. It can be helpful to get an ACTH with that blood draw as well to confirm that the patient actually took the milligram of dexamethasone. If they did, that ACTH should be very low in the morning. And with those tests, it is usually possible to make at least a preliminary assessment as to whether you have a functioning adrenal tumor. We also, of course, would add a plasma meninephrine screening for pheochromocytoma. So with those relatively straightforward and relatively complete, I would say, blood tests, you should be able to make an assessment as to whether you have a functioning or a non-functioning tumor. Sometimes the results will come back and will be equivocal, and additional testing will be necessary. But usually, you can determine based on those results.
Dr. Lee, can you just explain what's the purpose of the DHEAS and how does that change what you would do?
Yeah, sure. In a patient with a with subclinical Cushing's or with frank Cushing's, the DHEAS is usually suppressed. So a pattern of an elevated morning cortisol, a suppressed morning ACTH, or a lack of suppression to the 1 milligram overnight dexamethasone suppression test, together with a low normal or a frankly low DHEAS, can help when you're trying to determine whether a patient might have a subtle evidence of subclinical Cushing's. What we're finding more and more as we look more carefully at patients with small to medium-sized adrenal nodules, and we're really talking about adrenal nodules in the 1 to 2, 2.5 centimeter range that are typically picked up as incidentalomas, often in middle-aged adults who have CAT scans done for other reasons, MRIs done for other reasons. It is more and more common that we will identify evidence of subclinical dysfunction of the adrenal gland, that is particularly evidence of lack of diurnal variation of the cortisol level that leads to a mild degree of hypercortisolism, mild Cushing syndrome, and we think that that puts the patient at risk for a host of medical problems, including unintended weight gain, hypertension, either poor glucose tolerance or frank diabetes, calcium loss from bones and so forth. Exactly the things that we see in Cushing syndrome, but to a somewhat lesser degree, yet over a period of many years, if not treated, can mean a detriment to that individual's health. So the DHEAS helps to interpret, for example, a dexamethasone suppression result that would be in the intermediate range, that is between 2 and 5, where we suspect that there may be hypercortisolism, but we like to see additional evidence of that, particularly before recommending surgery to a patient with a relatively small adrenal tumor.
And now that we've ruled out that the tumor is it's a non-functioning tumor, and we've ruled out that it's a functioning tumor, what imaging characteristics make you more wary and more likely to operate?
Right. So, certainly size is still the single best predictor of malignancy in an adrenal nodule. We use size criteria to recommend to patients whether or not they should have that adrenal nodule removed. What that means is the larger the tumor, the more likely it is to be cancer. Of course, most primary adrenal cancers are over 6 centimeters in size. Most adrenal tumors that are 4 centimeters or less are benign, and those between 4 and 6 centimeters are in a gray zone. That being said, we also take the age of the patient and their health status into account in recommending surgery for a non-functioning incidentaloma. So we would be much more likely to follow a 3 centimeter, even a 4 centimeter nodule in an elderly adult who has competing comorbidities and a young, healthy patient with even a 2 centimeter nodule. We will often recommend, since the choices are lifelong follow-up or removal, even a 2 centimeter nodule, we'll often recommend that they have surgery. Beyond that, we look hard at the details of the imaging characteristics of the tumor, although honestly most, and it's important for the audience to be aware that most incidental adrenal nodules will be in the small to medium size range and will have imaging characteristics of a benign tumor. That is, They will have low density. They will have rapid washout, and they will be very regular and homogeneous. So adrenal tumors that have low density on CAT scan, they have their Hounsfeld units are are in general 10 or less. Those are benign tumors because they contain a high degree of fat density, and fat within an adrenal nodule is a characteristic of a benign adrenocortical adenoma. Likewise, they should be relatively homogeneous in appearance. They should not have areas of low and high density mixed within them. They should not be necrotic. They should not have evidence of liquid or liquefaction, and they should be regular in their contours. They should not appear to be attached to or invade other structures. We look for a nice fat plane around all aspects of the adrenal tumor. So, if the adrenal tumor shows any worrisome features outside of the benign features that I've described, then that would be an adrenal nodule, really of any size, that we would consider for early removal. Those imaging features are uncommon, and if you see an adrenal nodule that has Hounsfeld units that are a little over 10, that's a little inhomogeneous, but still regular, those are usually atypical adenomas. We may remove them, but it's important probably for people to understand that in most cases what you'd be removing is an atypical adenoma, we would say, rather than an adrenal cancer.
So, which it seems like every time I look or I read about this, it seems like we're going after smaller and smaller tumors. So, are you saying for a young, you know, good operative candidate with a low density, you know, 2 centimeter tumor, that you would offer that person a resection?
I would. I think that you know, first of all, with the availability of minimally invasive, particularly retroperitoneoscopic approaches to these tumors, with the knowledge that that these tumors do tend to grow, although very slowly over time, with the knowledge that these tumors, and although it's still poorly defined what the frequency is of conversion to functioning tumors, that they can convert to functioning tumors, I would have that discussion with, you know, if we're talking about a 35-year-old individual, I would on the one hand talk to that individual about the fact that we're going to be following that tumor for a while, and also, I would look at that individual a little more closely for evidence of subclinical Cushing's. In other words, if I'm going to leave that adrenal nodule in, I'd like to see a post-dex cortisol level that's less than 2. And I might even do some salivary cortisol levels and I'd look at the DHEAS hard. In other words, I would look for evidence, because I don't want to miss subclinical Cushing's in a patient like that. Doesn't mean I wouldn't follow the patient if the patient was inclined to be followed rather than have surgery immediately. I think that's completely reasonable. But I also wouldn't argue with removing a 2-centimeter adrenal tumor in a young, healthy person.
So let's say that if the person, you know, maybe opts for surveillance, how often do you image them, and what rate of growth gets you concerned?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a question, of course, about which there's incomplete data. There are a couple of somewhat different recommendations from the NIH, from the Endocrine Society, and so forth, that that have put together recommendations. I think if an individual has a 1 centimeter nodule and they're an older adult, and you have done the screening evaluation that I laid out, and they have some comorbidities, I think a single follow-up imaging study, and that imaging study ideally, although it could be a CAT scan in that patient, ideally would be one that didn't involve radiation exposure, so therefore an MRI a year from the first evaluation, and then if there's no change, I would stop. So that's the type of patient in whom I think a very limited follow-up evaluation is completely appropriate. That nodule on the order of 1.5 centimeters is, on the one hand, almost certainly not a health risk to the patient, and on the other hand, almost certainly not going to grow to a size, if they're 70, let's say, that it would be a candidate for removal over the rest of their life expectancy. On the other hand, an individual who's young, a 35-year-old woman, for example, with a 2-centimeter nodule who we've decided to follow, that's an individual I would get imaging in 6 months, then in a year, and then if it was stable, probably 2 years after that, in an attempt to document stability. And again, I like to move from CAT scan to MR with the second imaging study because of the desire to reduce the individual's exposure to radiation, and because the primary factor at that point in that individual is growth. In other words, if that tumor gets bigger, it should then come out. You're not necessarily looking for subtle changes in the appearance, but rather you're looking at size, and MR should be more than sufficient to do that. In a young patient also, at the time that I did the follow-up imaging studies, either at 6 months or a year, probably at a year, I would repeat the hormone evaluation to look for any evidence that this was becoming a hormonally productive tumor. I wouldn't do everything, but I would do a morning cortisol ACTH and a DHEAS, and then I would repeat the DEXA suppression test if I had any concern that the patient might have subclinical Cushing's.
What's the role, if any, for selective venous sampling? Is this for any of the functional tumors? Is this just something that you read about in textbooks, or does this actually happen?
No, I think it can be a very helpful test, particularly for patients with hyperaldosteronism. It can be really helpful. We've explored the use of selective venous sampling for cortisol-producing tumors, but I would just say it hasn't been particularly helpful. But for aldosterone-producing tumors, it can be helpful. There is an ongoing debate in the literature as to whether all patients with hyperaldosteronism should undergo selective venous sampling, or whether it should be limited to for example, to patients over 50 or patients with bilateral adrenal nodules on imaging, since those are situations where the risk of the identified adrenal nodule on imaging being on the wrong side is higher. We tend to use selective venous sampling relatively liberally for patients with hyperaldosteronism who we're planning to take to the operating room. And that's partly based on the fact that we have a tremendous interventional radiology team who are very experienced. It is an operator-dependent procedure. In other words, it is not easy to cannulate that short right adrenal vein accurately and get and get reliable results, particularly from that short fat right adrenal vein that empties directly into the vena cava. And therefore, the interpretation, if the interventional radiologist is having trouble cannulating that vein, it can be really difficult to interpret the results that come back. The test is also quite safe in the hands of experienced interventional radiologists like we have at MD Anderson and as are available at many medical centers around the country. In other words, thrombosis of an adrenal vein with ischemia of the resulting adrenal gland is very uncommon, and bleeding is also very uncommon as a complication, hemorrhage of the adrenal as a result of the procedure. So we think it is in our hands a safe and accurate procedure. And the second major reason for doing it and having a relatively liberal approach to doing selective venous sampling is in this day and age, we really hate to take the wrong adrenal gland out. And therefore, if there is any significant risk, nodularity to the opposite adrenal gland, even if it's subtle, a relatively modestly sized adrenal nodule on one side, a centimeter or less in size, evidence of possible hyperplasia with a lumpy, bumpy appearance to the adrenal glands, and certainly an older adult. Those are situations, even in the face of well-documented hyperaldosteronism, we would really prefer to have selective venous sampling before we take out the adrenal gland.
Sir, thank you for that very comprehensive review. And for the next portion of our podcast, we move on to what's called the tips and tricks, where we ask you, the master, how to perform an adrenalectomy. And you mentioned the term retroperitoneoscopic adrenalectomy. Before we get there, I'd like to ask you, how do you get to an adrenal gland? How do you decide whether you're going to do them open or minimally invasive? And what is your approach to getting to the right and left adrenal gland, both anteriorly and posteriorly?
Sure. Historically, obviously there are a number of different surgical approaches to the adrenal gland. Open approaches were described first and include open anterior approaches, a standard approach that all of us are familiar and comfortable with, a relatively large anterior incision, typically moving the organs, the anterior organs out of the way on the left or the right. On the left side, the spleen and pancreas, the splenic flexure of the colon, the stomach. On the right side, moving the liver out of the way to get back to the adrenal gland, the kidney, and the vena cava. Urologists in particular have used an open flank approach for decades. An approach that I have very rarely used for patients with adrenal tumors in my practice, even over 25 years. When I started on faculty at Anderson, we were still doing open posterior adrenalectomies, removing the bottom rib, going through an incision in the back to get up to the adrenal gland. We did that for patients with metastatic cancer and in patients with advanced breast cancer, believe it or not, as a therapeutic maneuver in some of those patients as well. But of course, more recently, we've tended to approach many patients, especially those with presumed benign tumors of the adrenal gland, both of the adrenal cortex and pheochromocytomas, patients with small to medium-sized tumors of the adrenal gland, patients with both functioning and non-functioning tumors of the adrenal gland, patients with small to medium-sized metastatic disease involving the adrenal gland via minimally invasive approaches. The first approach that was described, still a very good approach, is an anterior transperitoneal approach. Patients are often put in a lateral or semilateral position, often placed in a reverse Trendelenburg position, typically use three or four ports in a subcostal location, and use typically, you know, the standard relatively low insufflation pressures. That the advantages of that approach, of course, is that it is minimally invasive, and it is an anatomic approach that all of us who trained in the era, certainly of open surgery, are very comfortable with, moving the abdominal organs out of the way and to get back to the adrenal gland in the retroperitoneum. It's a really good approach. It's one that I still use for some patients. And then there's the retroperitoneoscopic approach that I'll talk about in a little more detail in just a few minutes. In terms of selecting patients for open versus minimally invasive adrenalectomy, it really depends on the goals of the operation. In general, of course, we're trying to remove the tumor completely, and we're trying to do that in a way that minimizes the downsides to the patients, the risk of the operation, but also the expected morbidity and the rapidity of recovery. We do prefer still open adrenalectomy if we think that we're dealing with a primary adrenal cancer, that is an adrenocortical cancer. And we've written about this relatively extensively. It has been a controversial issue in the literature, but we continue to believe, since most patients with adrenocortical cancers present with very large tumors, as I mentioned, over 6 centimeters, typically 7, 8, 9, 12, 15 centimeter tumors. Since these primary adrenocortical cancers typically invade adjacent organs and often require multi-organ resection, on the left side, of course, the spleen, the pancreas, the kidney, sometimes the stomach, sometimes the colon. On the right side, the liver, the kidney, the vena cava. For that reason, usually an open adrenalectomy is really the only appropriate approach for these patients. An additional reason for preferring an open approach for patients with primary adrenal cancer is the nature of the cancers themselves. As opposed to patients, for example, most patients with colon cancer, other solid tumors, adrenocortical cancers are typically very soft tumors. They're friable, they're easily fractured, and once they're fractured, they implant. It's the nature of the tumor, of the underlying tumor biology. If you violate the capsule of an adrenal cancer, which can be done open or as a minimally invasive procedure, but seems based on both a retrospective analyses from a number of institutions, including ourselves and University of Michigan, but of patients who had surgery elsewhere and then were referred to us, but also based on an understanding of current instrumentation for minimally invasive surgery and the types of approaches that we take to adrenal tumors, where we really, at some point during the operation, have to manipulate the tumor itself in order to get it out. The tumors, it's very common for the tumors to become fractured if we try to remove a primary adrenal cancer as a minimally invasive operation. So for those reasons, we prefer an open approach for primary adrenal cancers. On the other hand, for, you know, tumors up to 8 or 9 centimeters, even if we believe that the tumor itself is likely to be firm, does not invade adjacent structures, relatively well circumscribed, not necrotic, a minimally invasive approach is, I think, ideal and and indicated. And that includes non-functioning and functioning adrenocortical tumors, pheochromocytomas, metastases, selected patients with metastasis to the adrenal glands.
With regards to your operative technique for the retroperitoneoscopic approach.
Sure. So we've been approaching patients, selected patients with adrenal tumors via a retroperitoneoscopic approach at MD Anderson for probably about a decade now. We learned this technique directly from Martin Walls in Germany. Martin has probably the largest experience in the world. He developed the technique. He didn't invent it, but he really developed it into a practical approach to the removal of patients with adrenal tumors. There was recently a small randomized trial, a European trial, that compared a transperitoneal laparoscopic approach to adrenalectomy to a retroperitoneoscopic approach to adrenalectomy, and found that the patients who underwent a retroperitoneoscopic approach had less pain and had a quicker recovery even than the anterior laparoscopic approach. So our experience has been that it's very well tolerated by the patients and has typically a very low morbidity. We can often discharge patients the same day if they're motivated. That seems to be quite safe. So the standard technique is done with the patient in a prone jackknife position. We prefer to use an orthopedic or neurosurgical table, a Cloward table, to do this procedure. This lets the abdomen hang anteriorly. It's padded and has a cutout for the abdomen, and allows for ideal positioning. A little arch of the back that opens up the space between the bottom of the rib cage and the top of the pelvis. The standard approach uses three ports. The middle port is placed about 2 centimeters beneath the tip of the 12th rib, and the medial and lateral ports are then spaced out to take advantage of the maximum available space. The medial port is placed just lateral to the paraspinous muscle beneath the 12th rib, and a little cephalad typically to the middle port. The lateral port is placed typically beneath the tip of the 11th rib, which comes down extends a little lateral to that 12th rib, beneath the tip of the 11th rib, lateral, and again slightly cephalad to the middle port site. We make the incision for the middle port first. That incision has to be large enough to admit your index finger of your dominant hand, because that you will use that finger to confirm entry into the retroperitoneal space and to guide the placement of the two other ports. So you make a skin incision, you go down to the muscular fascia, 2 centimeters beneath the tip of the 12th rib. You then enter that fascia. The standard way to do that is with scissors, as if you were essentially stabbing the patient in the back. It's a very safe space to get into. The kidney is there, but it's quite a bit anterior and protected by the perinephric fat. So you enter the retroperitoneal space with scissors. In some patients, particularly older adults, you can often enter that retroperitoneal space completely bluntly with gentle pressure from your fingertip, and that's the way that I do it now. At least I try to do it now, and if I can't, then I resort to the scissors. Enter the retroperitoneal space. You'll feel your finger pass through the muscular fascia, and then you'll feel the perinephric fat fall away around your finger, and that's the sign that you're in that space. Then we place the medial port second. That's a typically a 12 millimeter straight port. As I mentioned, it's placed medial and slightly cephalad to the middle port. It's angled cephalad towards the anticipated location of the adrenal gland, about 30 degrees of an angle, just lateral to that paraspinous muscle on the outside, and of course the psoas muscle on the inside. You can, as you place the port, you should feel for the entry of the port by putting your index finger in through that middle port site, so that you can help direct the medial port into an ideal position. Port placement is absolutely critical for this operation. It's not nearly as forgiving as it is, for example, for an anterior laparoscopic approach. And then the lateral port is placed. I have moved towards using the AirSeal device completely for this operation. It's such a beautiful setup system. You can do the operation without it. We did it for a number of years without AirSeal, but the AirSeal really maintains that relatively small anatomic working space with constant insufflation in a way that really facilitates the operation. So I use what's called a 5, but is really an 8 millimeter air seal through that in that lateral position. And again, it's lateral and cephalad to the middle port site beneath the tip of the 11th rib and angled posterior and cephalad towards the anticipated location of the adrenal gland in it and the adrenal tumor. Once that port is in, and again, you feel for the position of the port with using your index finger through the middle port site, you you put your middle port in, which is a balloon port, a 12 millimeter 30 cc balloon port. Put that port in, use a little KY to make sure it slides in easily. Insufflate the balloon with air, put the port collar in place, and you're ready to go. I would say at this point mention a little clinical pearl, and that is, you know, many of our patients, particularly those with Cushing's or subclinical Cushing's, but even those who don't have that condition, have obesity, including truncal obesity nowadays. And it's absolutely critical for a successful operation, ideally before you take the patient to the operation, that you measure the subcutaneous fat at the place where you're going to be putting that middle balloon port in. I will tell you, even with the obesity instruments that we have at MD Anderson, the working distance between the bottom of the port collar and the top of the balloon for the longer balloon port that we have available is 65 millimeters, 6.5 centimeters. So I always measure, and this is, you know, this was a mistake that I made early on. I always measure the distance on the CAT scan or the MRI between the skin and the retroperitoneal space beneath the tip of the 12th rib on the cross-sectional imaging, and make sure that it's no more than 65 millimeters. If it is, then you're better off going anterior. You know, that operation won't be easy however you do it, but an anterior laparoscopic approach in that patient, if they carry their weight on their hips, as it were, is better off done anterior than posterior. Most patients, though, even if they're a little overweight, can... even frankly obese can have the operation done retroperitoneoscopically. So once the ports are in, we start insufflation with the AirSeal device up to about 16 millimeters, and we make certain that we're in the correct space. I like to do this with a 10 millimeter 30 degree angle camera through the middle port. Occasionally it'll be helpful to go to a 5 millimeter camera through the lateral port, or to move that camera to the medial port. But I prefer to use the camera through the middle port and operate through each of the two each of the medial and lateral ports. We start out with the camera in the middle port and with Kittners through each of the medial and lateral ports, and we use blunt dissection to define anatomic landmarks and enlarge the retroperitoneal space. We look first for the posterior aspect of the kidney, and second for the psoas muscle. Once we've identified those anatomic landmarks, that confirms to us that we're in the retroperitoneal space and that we haven't, for example, put the lateral port into lateral and entered the peritoneal cavity, or put the lateral port too high and entered the chest cavity. Those things can happen. They're uncommon. They can happen. If they do happen, one doesn't necessarily have to stop the operation. Often one can reposition the ports, deal with the pneumothorax, and just or with the degree of pneumoperitoneum and proceed with the operation. Most of the time, of course, the ports are in exactly the right space, and the anatomic landmarks are clear, and one can proceed with the operation. The next step in the operation is critically important, is to free the superior pole of the kidney from the periadrenal fatty tissue, the adrenal gland, and the tumor. This is absolutely essential. And just like if we're doing an anterior laparoscopic operation, you you move things out of the way and you trust that the adrenal gland and the tumor will be in the correct place and it will come into view in due time. It's not necessary, and it's actually counterproductive, to immediately try to see the adrenal gland or the tumor. So the next step in the operation is to free the superior pole of the adrenal gland from that perinephric fat. Once that's done, and I take a lot of time to completely free that pole so that you can actually lift it posteriorly with your instruments, it's really helpful. The more you do early in the operation, the easier the last few steps in the operation are. Typically we'll dissect laterally and then medially to free the adrenal gland and perinephric fat from their attachments. We don't typically look for the adrenal vein until we've done these two steps, that is the medial lateral dissection. But once we've done the medial and lateral dissections, typically the adrenal vein, which of course is entering the left renal vein on the left side and entering directly the vena cava on the right side, will come into view during that medial dissection in particular. Sometimes, particularly on the right side, you won't see the adrenal vein until the tumor is almost out. And that's because the adrenal vein on the right side enters the vena cava on the posteromedial aspect of the vena cava. And therefore, the adrenal tumor can be sitting, when you're looking from the back, the adrenal gland and the tumor can be sitting right on the adrenal vein. That's okay. You know, that the old adage that you should, with a pheo in particular, divide the adrenal vein early, with modern anesthesia really is not a big concern. It's more important that when you divide the adrenal vein, you do it safely, and that you're you have good mobility on that adrenal vein so that you can get your clips on and do a safe and complete division in one step. So we mobilize the adrenal gland from all of its attachments, including the anterior attachments. Then next, we leave the superior attachments of the adrenal gland for last. And the reason for that is it minimizes the amount of actual manipulation of the adrenal gland and the tumor that you have to do. It's tempting and it looks easy to divide those superior attachments early. The first few of these you do, you'll be tempted to do that because they're right in your face. and it looks like an easy way to make progress. It is an easy way to make progress, but it will come back to haunt you because what it means is then from that point on, you've got to be pushing and tugging on that fragile adrenal gland and tumor for the remainder of the operation. You'll get more bleeding. It'll tend to fracture and you'll regret it. So we leave those superior attachments for last or for next to last if in the case of an adrenal vein on the right side that's right underneath your tumor. Once you've divided the adrenal vein, we typically do that by double clipping the staying side, single clipping the coming outside, and then either using energy or scissors to divide the vein itself. There's not much left to the operation. Typically move the camera to the medial port at that point, put an endo bag in through the middle port, put the adrenal gland and tumor into the endo bag, and remove it through the middle port. Sometimes if the tumor is larger, you'll have to enlarge, of course, that middle port side by a centimeter or so in order to get the tumor out within the endo bag. I like Exparel. I use it it helps, especially if you're planning to discharge the patients the same day. We don't attempt to close the fascia at any of the port sites. Hernias are really uncommon unless you've had to enlarge. You're dealing with a particularly big tumor and have had to enlarge that middle port site a great deal. We don't typically close the fascia. We use a little local anesthesia on the way out, and that's really all there is to it. It's almost always a straightforward operation, especially if the port positioning has been done correctly and carefully. We typically get chest X-rays on these patients in the recovery room. We'll get them in the operating room if we have a high degree of suspicion based on what anesthesia tells us or port placement that we might have a pneumothorax. An occasional patient will need a little chest tube. Sometimes patients will have a tiny pneumothorax that won't require a tube, even if there is a little pneumo. That would be, the most common acute complication of this operation, probably 1 or 2% of patients.
Well, thank you, sir, for that extremely thorough explanation of the procedure. And what we're going to do is we're actually going to post a video on our podcast for our listeners so they can follow along through the video with the steps that you went through. And I think that'll be extremely helpful to all of us. So we really appreciate you taking us through that. Now we want to close out our podcast, and we close it out with the final five. And this is a 5 questions we ask all of our guests to get to know them a little bit better. And the first question we wanted to ask you is, do you listen to music in the operating room? And if so, what type of music?
I have been pretty famous for listening to music in the operating room. And the the thing that I say is and this is sort of silly, but start with Bach and end with rock. That means we start with classical music and we end with stuff that's pretty upbeat. And the reason I do that is that we're operating with trainees typically, and this wasn't necessary for Vance. Of course, he came to us fully trained and didn't need any help. But I like to calm everybody down. Especially in the early morning, and then when we're closing, I like to try to move things along so we can get to the next operation.
How about question number 2? Are there any hobbies, talents, or interests outside the operating room?
Yeah, I'm a car nut. I've been a car nut since I was a kid, the fact of the matter is I'll watch any race between two or more cars at any time. on any given Sunday. Unfortunately, I don't have as much time to do that as I'd like. But I'm a particular fan of Formula One racing. I was really delighted that that they built a Formula One track up outside of Austin, and I've been to every Formula One race up in Austin since they started having the series up there, and usually drag a few people up with me. My wife has been nice enough to go every year as well.
All right. Well, keeping with that theme, number three, what was your first car?
My first car, of course, like a lot of us probably, was my dad's car. Unfortunately my dad sold his 57 Chevy Bel Air right before I turned 16 and was able to get a learner's permit. I really, looking back on it, think he probably did that on purpose, because he knew it wouldn't be good for me. But my dad had a 72 Plymouth Duster with a 4-speed on the floor that was just such it was in the 70s, so it was an underpowered little car, but it was so much fun. I got so much really enjoyed that car. I had that car from the middle of college until my second year of medical school. Drove it across country. Took a month driving that car across country. Got a hole in the gas tank in driving up Pikes Peak on those dirt roads up Pikes Peak, and fixed the leaking gas tank in a parking lot in Las Vegas, motel parking lot, with chewing gum, a brass screw, and a piece of rubber sheeting that I happen to have in my toolbox. And it lasted till I sold the car a year later. It was a great car. That's great. I wish I still had it.
I'm imagining yellow. Is that, am I correct or not? Yellow car.
What's that?
I'm imagining a yellow car.
No,
I don't know why.
It was a mix of colors, mostly okay. Green. Yeah.
Okay, question number four. What would you be doing if you were not in medicine? I have an idea what you might answer for this, but.
Yeah, I probably, I would love to drive race cars, but I'm not nearly a good enough driver, and I'm too tall. If you look at people like Jeff Gordon and so forth, they're usually pretty short, and they're kind of gymnasts, and that's certainly not me. So I don't know. I might be unemployed or working at Starbucks.
And the final question, if you could go back in time and see yourself on the first day of internship, what advice would you give yourself?
I was talking to my mom, of all people, about this yesterday, because I have a daughter who just graduated from college. And you know, like a lot of us, I mean, some of us, you guys probably knew that you wanted to be surgeons from the time that you were in grade school, but that wasn't true of me. And even as an intern, I struggled with the fact of the idea of whether I was making the right decision. I really wanted to be a complete doctor, and to me, after having gone through medical school, surgery, particularly general surgery, offered me the opportunity, I thought, to do that, to take care of patients in a pretty complete way, and to have a direct impact on how the patients did and on helping them to get better. And surgery, more than any other specialty, seemed to offer that promise. And I guess what I would tell myself is that that's I think that's true. and that I would reassure myself that that I had really made the right decision. That it's been a fantastic specialty. Certainly training in general surgery was fantastic training, and although there was hardly a specialty called cancer surgery when, you know, when I was casting around for, it's hard to imagine when I was casting around for something to do with the rest of my life after I finished residency, there were relatively few programs. There was no ACGME certification, certainly for surgical oncology. And the cardiac surgeons that I trained with, you know, arched their eyebrows and looked at me like I was a crazy person when I said that I was thinking about specializing in surgery for patients with cancer, because, you know, in their mind, those patients couldn't be cured, and the surgeries weren't particularly challenging compared to, or very well thought out compared to what they were doing in heart surgery with heart transplants, valve replacements, and pediatric cardiac, for example. But it really has turned out to be a tremendous specialty, as, you know, as Vance can attest. I think that we have such an ability to impact patients' lives in a positive way, the patients that we cure, and even often the patients that we don't. And things are changing so fast in so many positive ways. We have and increasingly will have ways of accomplishing the same thing or achieving even better outcomes with less of a negative impact on patients, and integrating these treatments better with all of the wonderful advances that are coming from our colleagues in other specialties in medical oncology and radiation and diagnostic imaging and so forth. So I really would tell my younger self that it's been a great ride, and I was always making the right decisions.
Well, Dr. Lee, on behalf of the entire Behind the Knife team, we can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk to us today. That was very fascinating, very informative, and very thorough. And it was also a pleasure to have Dr. Vance Saun, one of your former trainees, here to talk as well. So, Dr. Lee, thanks again, and we hope to have you back on Behind the Knife.
You're welcome. Been wonderful. Thanks so much.
Until next time, dominate the day.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.